Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
You're listening to the Dana and Parks podcast on KMBZ.
Every day is not Valentine's, but you make it feel like most of the time. When I'm all alone with you, picking up pieces of my life, sometimes there's ones I just can't find, but they found a home with you. Oh, I'm not afraid to be alone, but being alone is better with you. Life is better with you. Oh, oh, life is better with you.
Michael Franti is your artist of the day, ladies and gentlemen, because he's happy, and it's Friday. And it might be chilly outside, but it still looks like a beautiful day through these windows today. Don't forget, we have Festivus Friday coming your way right after 5 o'clock, and that is brought to you by Michelob Ultra. If you'd like to weigh in this hour, we request you do it on the text line at 22980. Sam, am I free this hour to say the keyword? Okay, the keyword this hour is young. Y-O-U-N-G. Let me give you another number. Text that in to 72881, and you're in the running for $1,000 with the keyword to cash. Message and data rates may apply, and please do not text and drive. Your keyword this hour is young.
So we are thrilled, I believe for the first time since you and I have been together, Scott, to welcome...
First time ever.
Ever, Johnson County District Attorney Steve Howe into studio. I had forgotten you've been with the DA's office since 1991.
Correct.
You've been the acting DA 11 years, but you've been in that office a long time.
And not acting. No, he's
time.
Not the acting DA. He's the DA.
The DA. You're acting currently as we speak as the DA. But you've been there since 91.
Correct. I've seen a lot of change here in Johnson County over those years.
You've seen a lot of cases.
Yes,
put a lot of bad people in prison.
Unfortunately, we have plenty of business.
Did you watch the Johnny Robinson thing last week on 2020?
I did.
What did you think of it? Other than the horrible in the car Amy Rohrbach stand up when she was really in New York City, but
trying to pretend like
she
was
here.
Yeah.
I really felt sorry for that young lady, and I really wish she hadn't gone through that because you could see the pain that she was going through. And I don't know if it was necessary to do that story to put her through that pain. That's kind of my thoughts.
I've always said in the media, we're really good at telling the story up front when the crime happens, and sometimes we're good at following up on the punishment phase. And then it goes away. And you know for the families, it doesn't ever go away.
No. And, you know, when you lose a loved one, especially the way she did, she'll live with that for the rest of her life. And you can tell it's still tormenting her. And so it was kind of tough to watch because I don't think she'll ever get peace. And John Robinson is a manipulator, and he will continue to manipulate people. And, you know, her comments that she wanted to find where her mother was, he's never going to tell her. Never. And he'll use that as leverage on her. And so I wish her the best, and I hope she continues to get counseling so she can move on.
But leverage for what? Just to his own narcissistic means? Or I mean, because she doesn't have anything of value that he's allowed to have.
I think for his own sick pleasure. That's the way he operates.
Have you ever spoken to Johnny Robinson? Not to continue this over from last week, but I just find that case... because I covered it when it first broke, and I was at the Lenexa Police Department. Dana, I think you were as well. As reporters, the two of us were there. And I've always found this case so fascinating and disturbing. Have you ever spoken with him?
I have not spoken with him.
Does the DA's office in Johnson County even try to open up a line of communication with him, or do you just consider that done and gone?
We don't talk to, well, first of all, usually they have lawyers that prevent us from talking directly with them, even through the appellate process.
For the love of God, he's on death row.
I know. But he still has lawyers appointed to him because he's fighting his conviction. And so because of that, we don't have conversations with him, nor do I think there's any value in talking to a sociopath like him. All he's going to do is try to manipulate the situation.
We hear this question from our listeners all the time. We ask this out loud all the time. Why don't we kill people on death row in Kansas? There are several of them there. You've put some of them there. Why are they still there?
You know, that's a real good question, and I wish I had a real simple answer. For some reason, Kansas, the route to get to the point where someone is executed is a very twisted route compared to other states. And I'm not sure why it's taking so long for us to do what the juries have prescribed, which is execute an individual because of the heinous crimes that they've committed. And, you know, we don't do the death penalty very often in Kansas. And if
we haven't done it at all in the modern era.
But the people who are on death row are the rogues gallery of worst of the worst murders.
It's the worst of the worst.
And so I think prosecutors for decades have really used good discretion on targeting these sociopaths, these really dangerous people who put prison guards at risk because they're so dangerous. And so I wish we could be a little bit more effective in getting to the finish line so we could put an end to these cases.
Who have you put on death row?
It would be Mr. Cross from the Jewish Community.
Oh, yes, of course.
Who is, by the way, who reported that he was near death, is still alive and in the penitentiary. So, again, to me, that was a big show.
Do you think he's faking?
As far as
his health?
Oh, he had COPD, but a lot of people have COPD, and that's all he had. And, you know,
he had to be wheeled into court.
That was an act. He could walk around.
That's what I mean. So he's acting.
Yeah, he's acting because he could walk around when the cameras weren't playing.
Huh.
And so that was all part of his little act that he put in place.
One of the things we're going to talk about this hour is identity theft, of all things. And I know that many of you listening have been victimized. I've been victimized. You mentioned during the commercial break, Steve, you have been a victim.
Yes.
Of identity theft.
Yes.
And there is an interesting case coming up in front of the United States Supreme Court, and it involves Kansas.
Who steals the identity of the DA?
Right? Whoops! And
they still got away with it.
It involves the state of Kansas. And you mentioned you have charged about 1,000 cases in the last 10 years in Johnson County for identity theft. I think people will think that number sounds low for as many victims as we know that there are. Why is that?
Because so many of these cases, the fraud is occurring over the internet, and we can't reach out to foreign countries or other locations because we don't have the jurisdiction to do that. And so many of these identity thefts are organized groups that are outside our country.
But some of them, you said, rove in and out. What? Tell me about that.
Well, you know, it used to be that organized crime would deal with drugs. Now they have found it's far more profitable to use identity theft and other fraud. And so what they'll do is we'll see bands of people coming in town and within a 72, 96 hours commit tons of identity theft and then roll out of town to the next jurisdiction. And so we see a lot of that going on. That's when we see like groups bringing in skimmers like on ATMs and also at gas stations. And so they hit you and then they move on. And we've been fortunate to catch some of these groups, but sometimes we don't.
Like they roll in like vagabonds and
yeah.
Yes, absolutely. They'll come in.
They have no permanent address. They just stay in town for a couple days and
yes, skim your cards. And then they'll run up, max out your cards
here in town.
In town. And a lot of times they'll use like gift cards and stuff like that and send it to another location. You know, what's really weird is a lot of these organized groups, we track them back to Brooklyn, New York.
Why?
And I don't know why, but that is a mecca for identity theft is these groups seem to be based out of Brooklyn, New York. It's the weirdest thing, but we have multiple times tracked them back there.
Should you now, when you go get gas, physically walk inside and have them take your money at the counter versus swiping that card?
I think what's important is look at the actual machine and make sure that it doesn't look like there's an add-on to it, because what they do is they put a little device on top of the actual swipe, and then you don't see it. And so I'm paranoid now because I've seen it happen to myself. I look really closely at the swipe to make sure it's not an add-on.
All right, we're visiting with Johnson County District Attorney Steve Howe. If you have a question, you're welcome to text it in at 22980, 22980, your keyword this hour, and that number is 72881. is Young, Y-O-U-N-G, Young, 72881.
Bad boys, what you want?
Joining us in studio is Johnson County District Attorney Steve Howe. Have you ever arrested somebody?
Have I? No, I have not personally arrested somebody.
I mean, you could.
Do you want to?
I let law enforcement do that job. No, I would not.
So you have an exciting week up ahead.
Yes.
Have you ever been to the United States Supreme Court?
I have been in the court, but not during arguments. And so this is... Hey, this is the Super Bowl for lawyers, is to go and have one of your cases, actually three of them, before the United States Supreme Court. And so we're very excited about having this opportunity to hear our case.
So Derek Schmidt's going to argue.
Yes.
I'm guessing he's really, really prepared for that.
Yes. And in fact, we've done a lot of preparation. They do little tests, questioning with him. And, you know, Derek, or the general, I guess I should say.
Derek Schmidt, by the way, is the attorney general of the state
yes.
of Kansas.
He actually did the Carr Brothers case as well.
Yeah.
So he's got experience going up before the U.S. Supreme Court, and he will do a fabulous job. He's really good.
Case is about identity theft and specifically a form that we all have to fill out when you get a job.
Right. The I-9 form.
The old I-9. And what is on the I-9? Basically, what is it?
Well, you fill out all your personal identifiers, including your Social Security number. And so that is the information on there. And it's supposed to be used. The I-9 is supposed to be so employers can verify that you are lawfully in this country.
So what has happened with this piece of paper that has brought you guys in front of the United States Supreme Court?
So we had three individuals in Johnson County who were not legally in this country, who put down other people's Social Security numbers that resulted in them having a tax implication because the W-2s and the K-2s go back to their Social Security number. Those three individuals came to the attention of law enforcement for a variety of reasons. And when we looked at it, we found out that they were using someone else's Social Security number. And just like any other person, if you're doing that in my county, I'm going to charge you with identity.
So if they take my Social Security number and they write it down on this I-9 and they say they are Dana, I am going to go and do my taxes one day and I'm going to say, this is what I made. I work here at Intercom. And someone eventually is going to say to me, no, you don't. You also work here and we want your money from the income that you made at a job that I've never even heard about.
Absolutely. And the IRS will be sending you a little nasty gram, basically saying you're not reporting all your income.
But it's not my income.
But why is that so hard to figure out?
Oh.
I mean, Dana Wright works at Intercom. She doesn't work at
Tom's
two-bit hardware store in Merriam.
And I will tell you from talking to people who have gone through this, it can take up to 6 to 8 months to clear your name with the IRS. Because you basically have to prove that that's not your income. And so that's why we feel so strongly about going after these cases, because there's real implications on these Social Security holders because they have to correct this.
Well,
and we have to get a conviction in order to show the IRS that, yeah, this person is truly a victim and not somebody just doing some kind of scam.
And Scott, you say, why can't you figure it out? Have you ever tried to call the IRS?
I must confess, I never have.
Get in line just to find a person to listen that this has happened to you with all of the identity theft we're seeing is impossible.
Right. And, you know, the latest numbers from the federal government is 26 million people have been victims of identity theft. And so if you think of it in that terms, I mean, my gosh, it is a total national problem.
So the case next week is what? This is a federal form, and you want to be able to go after these people based on a lie on a federal form.
Well, we can't use that federal form to prosecute for identity theft, but if they then subsequently use it on other forms like our K-2 or W-2 forms, what we're saying is we should, as a state, be able to go after them if they continue to use that same Social Security number in other ways. We cannot, by federal law, use that I-9 form as part of the prosecution.
Because you're a state attorney.
Correct. And that's a federal form, and it was done for federal purposes. And so we don't disagree with that. But that doesn't mean it gives you a license to use that Social Security number
right.
for infinity and cause all kinds of damage.
How was your identity stolen?
I was actually moving my daughter out to Colorado, and somebody somewhere down the road, I got my card skimmed. And because I never lost my card, whether it was at a restaurant or a gas station or something, and then bam, I had like $5,000 or $6,000 of charges on my
card. And your bank never called you?
They did. But that was how quick these people hit. They hit us. See, the problem was they started racking up the charges in Denver where I was.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't until they went to Vegas and partied in Vegas that all of a sudden my credit card company.
Sure, they were the ones that were partying in Vegas. Okay.
Did you say to them when they called you, do you know who I am?
No, no.
Did you ever catch them?
No, no.
No.
And that's the conundrum that we're always under is there's a vast majority of these cases never get solved because it is so difficult to track them down. Yeah.
So let us know the outcome, you know, when we hear it, of course, on the identity form, identity theft case, because that's interesting. But the other case going in front of the U.S. Supreme Court,
it
also involves Kansas and the insanity defense. And something, Steve, that Scott and I did not know until we read it in the news last week. And we will talk about that coming up. I think a lot of people are going to be surprised to hear about it.
Did you stay at the Bellagio?
No, I did not.
Okay. All right. I'm just asking. I'm
under cross examination.
Well, it was the win.
His name is Steve Howe. He is your Johnson County District Attorney. Your keyword this hour is young. You have another 25 minutes to text that into 72881. Young, you're in the running for $1,000 with the keyword to cash. Message and data rates may apply. Please do not text and drive.
So really quick, and we won't spend a lot of time on this because it's kind of getting into the weeds with something that most people are never going to hopefully encounter, but the state of Kansas does not have a traditional insanity defense, and that is the other case that is going in front of the United States Supreme Court. I mean, it's odd. Kansas has all of these cases in front of the highest court right now.
Yeah, it is kind of. I know it's really put a lot of stress on the Attorney General's office because literally in a, I think it's almost like a 40-day period or 45-day period, they've got three arguments before the U.S. Supreme Court. So kudos to them. And I know they're putting a lot of work in to get to put the best face forward for the state of Kansas. And I don't think people realize how much work goes into being before the U.S. Supreme Court.
So there are only a handful of states that no longer allow the traditional insanity defense, and that's basically what's in front of the court. Do you have the right to use that defense, which almost never works, but do you have the right to use it and try it anyway?
Right, and especially in this instance, what they're arguing is it's a death penalty case. And so because they like to argue that death is different and that someone should have the capacity to be able to put that defense forward, allowing them to have due process. And so it's an interesting argument because Kansas is in the minority as far as not having an insanity defense. We used to have the McNaughton rule is what it was called. And then it was actually interesting right before the Deborah Green case came through, the state legislature modified that law.
I would say, though, if you have the capacity to argue that you should be able to use a certain legal defense in your case, don't you also just have the capacity that you're sane? I mean, if you even have the capacity to bring up that I would like this defense instead of that defense, that says to me you have some level of understanding of what it is that you have done.
Are you arguing for the insanity defense or against it?
We're arguing that you don't have to have an insanity defense in your state, and that's where Kansas is.
It's Idaho and a couple of others,
yeah,
I believe,
Kansas
too.
Does not have it.
And you're in favor of that.
No, I agree. I'm in favor of that because it's still under the laws of the state of Kansas. You still have the capacity to make that argument. What it does is it limits when you can make that argument because you have to show that I could not formulate the intent to want to kill somebody.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said something in the last segment, and it kind of just kind of got glossed over. You were talking about the Attorney General, Derek Schmidt. And he has been, quote, I think I'm using your words right, in preparation. You guys role play this whole thing before you go to the Supreme Court?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it is a very intimidating situation because.
Are you intimidated?
Oh, I would be intimidated. Absolutely. Yes.
I mean, you're going to be there, but you're not going to You're not going to speak, are you?
No, I'm not going to speak. General Schmidt is. But I will tell you, that would be very difficult to do. It's a very technical argument, and it was really interesting as we're going through this process. It's a different type of legal argument than maybe we're used to here in Kansas, because the U.S. Supreme Court is not just looking at the impact in Kansas, but nationwide. And it's a different type of argument.
But when you role play these things, I'm assuming that you have people who pretend to be Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Clarence Thomas, et cetera. Where do you do this and when do you do it?
Well, I mean, it is done both internally, externally. There's law firms that can be used that are used to dealing with this situation. You can go to law schools and have law professors. So there's many different methods. And so to their credit, they don't go in cold. They actually test this out a number of times, because this is a very important argument that has a huge impact, not just in Kansas, but nationwide. And so you want to put your best foot forward. And I appreciate the hard work that they put in all these cases to go forth and really put forth, I think, a good argument before the U.S. Supreme Court. And these are some of our best legal scholars. And so if you think
I
of
hope
it,
so.
Yeah, I do believe, I mean, these people are really smart people. They didn't get there because of just politics. They also had to have some ability to project their ability to understand the law and apply it.
Let's get to some of the listener questions on the text line. Can you please ask the DA to talk about how his office handles or addresses the problem of teens sharing photos of themselves via social media?
Good question.
It is the biggest problem we're dealing with right now is sexting by teenagers that put them at risk. And if I had one piece of advice to parents, is when you have kids from 8 years old till they're of age of 18, is check their phone, check their electronics, and review it, because there are so many people that are preying on our youth and putting them at risk, and it could have life-changing impact. And we have seen it blow up where teens, because perhaps for a variety of reasons, will put pictures of them in compromising positions or, you know, half-clothed. And then that's always in the internet after that. And they can't get that back. And they don't think about those things. And many times it's because they're searching for love or you know, some kind of friendship, and people take advantage.
So clarify, because I think there are two sets of cases that we're dealing with. There's the predator online who's pretending to be a 15-year-old kid, and he's really a 60-year-old living in his mom's basement. That's over here, and that's bad. But there are listeners asking about the Romeo and Juliet 15, 16-year-old, and are those cases prosecuted, and if so, under what circumstance?
Okay, so that's a really good question. We see two scenarios. One, if it's a Romeo Juliet thing, typically if we find those, what we do is we take the phones and we wipe them, because we're not going to prosecute two 15-year-olds for exchanging photos. Under the law, you could, but we're not going to do that. The second scenario where we do prosecute is you have two 15-year-olds, and then let's say they break up and the boyfriend decides, I'm going to send it to the whole school.
Revenge porn.
Yep.
Revenge. And you know what? We do prosecute that, because that's devastating to that kid. And that is the intent to harm another individual. So we do prosecute those cases. But I can tell you, the police departments all the time wipe phones, because that is not something we want to protect those kids, not harm them.
Does that happen a lot, the revenge porn scenario?
More than you thought you would think. I mean, I
don't really think about it very much.
But I think it's generational. Yeah. I think it really is generational. And I think this generation is more inclined to do these types of things. And they're detached from the fact that this is real when they send that picture.
We have had listeners call in, Steve, and admit this happened and my daughter or son was caught up in it. And it's the kid you would never think. The straight A, you know, band, extracurricular. The kid that I always said would never, ever do something like this, was the kid caught up in something like this.
Right. And you know, I think we really use good judgment in when we go after a kid and when we don't. And again, if you're not intending to harm somebody, But it's just they're naive enough to exchange those pictures because they are, quote, in love as a 15 or 16 year old. That's not what we should be prosecuting.
Another good one from the text line. Did Johnson County do away with prosecuting non-payment of child support? Currently, my case is in arrears with 13,000 others. It will be a year or more before we even get a judge.
We did not get rid of it, but a couple years ago, we privatized it. And I thought that was the biggest mistake we ever made.
Whose decision was it?
That was the governor. Governor Brownback had led the charge to do that. I argued against that because our trustee's office did a fabulous job of enforcing those orders and getting people to pay. And I will tell you, since we privatized it, we hardly see any of those cases come into our office anymore. And it's a real sore point with me because so many people, you know, they have an obligation to help pay for their kids. And to me, it's wrong to hold a parent who's now a single parent responsible without any kind of monetary benefit by the other person who doesn't have custody.
So when you say, real quick, clarify, it's privatized. If I came to you and said somebody owes $100,000 in child support, does your office now no longer have the teeth to go after that? It's just been handed off to a third party?
No. What it is, the trustee's office works with a private party who monitors and enforces the civil side of it. But see, what happens is we don't get those until they're referred to us from the, because other means have been exhausted and they won't pay and they're in arrears $30,000. And then they will refer it to our office to prosecute because they've tried other means. But unfortunately, we hardly see any of those anymore. And we used to have a pretty steady stream where people would hold them accountable. And I really feel for some of these single parents, and I wish we did a better job because we had a great system in place and we blew it up, and it's just another example. Sometimes government does do a good job at these things.
So to get the system back the way it was, would that take a law or an order from the current governor? How does that work?
It would take it would take an order by the governor to revamp that back to where we
were. Very quickly, because we got to get to the break, have you approached Laura Kelly about that?
No. I haven't approached her about it, but it's going to be hard to get government back involved and have, you know, with our tight budget it is, that I think it's going to be difficult to get that to happen. But I think we need to hold those private parties accountable to start feeding those cases to us so we can prosecute. I will say this. If you have a case and you're in Johnson County and they're in arrears, call our office and we'll start putting the private parties' feet to the fire to get them to forward that case to our office.
Steve Howe is the Johnson County District Attorney. He is in studio till the top of the hour. Then it is Festivus Friday, the airing of the grievances. That is brought to you by Michelob Ultra. Your keyword this hour is young.
It feels good. Yeah. It feels good.
All right, we're back with Johnson County District Attorney Steve Howe, who is ready to announce he's running for governor in 3 years. I'm totally kidding. I'm totally kidding.
We're seeing a couple of these. I think it's a fair question, and I know you cannot comment specifically on an active case. However, we have two students who are accused of physically bringing actual guns into school. And we have another student this week who is accused of pointing what has been described as a finger gun in class. And can you talk about the differences in those charges generally?
Yeah, one would be described as a criminal threat. So if I make a verbal threat to you that I'm going to do harm to you, that is considered a low-level felony. Right now, under Kansas law, if you bring a these two students bringing a gun into the school.
We're talking about Hawker Grove Middle School in Merriam.
Right. If you bring a gun into school right now, a juvenile in possession of a firearm, even in a school, is a misdemeanor.
And why?
Whoa, wait.
Yes, I read that. Yes.
Bringing a gun into a school is a misdemeanor.
Right. And so for a juvenile, a juvenile doing
what
that.
What if an adult does it?
An adult, it depends on the crime. It could be a felony.
Obviously, a police officer can do it with obviously no fear.
But that's an anomaly that, yeah, I've been asked that on a number of occasions. I agree that doesn't make a lot of sense, that if you bring a kid brings a gun into a school, that ought to be a little bit more serious crime. You know, the other thing I think that one of the takeaways that I try to reinforce to everybody is, you know, probably between 40% and 50% of our cases for these low-level felonies and misdemeanors get some kind of diversion where they don't get a criminal record, but they get the help they need.
In the juvenile cases.
Yes, in the juvenile cases. And I think that's really important for people to understand is our job isn't to just lock kids up who commit stupid crimes. Our job is to get them to help and change their behavior so they don't become adults and go down that road. And so I always caution people about don't just take what you see in text messages and, you know, and what's out on the internet as actual literal truth, and have some faith that law enforcement and the schools really use good judgment over and over again to evaluate threats.
What would you say are some of the biggest changes you have seen? You've been in the DA's office since 1991. What are some of the biggest changes you have seen in either the way crimes are brought to your office or crimes are prosecuted? Certainly the domestic violence stuff has changed since 1991. What are some of the other ones?
I think the biggest change for us, or what has the biggest impact, is now that we have all these body cams by law enforcement, it does two things. It creates a lot of extra work for us, and having to view those as part of our case. I think it's positive because those body cams allow the officer to not only be protected from false accusations, but it also allows the law enforcement agencies to know when they have a bad cop. So it's a win-win there, but it's a lot more work for us as far as, and then everything is electronic. All the videos and everything else, the amount of data and how big your hard drive systems have to be to store all that is becoming a real issue for not only prosecutors, but law enforcement. And so we're having to put stuff out on the cloud and store it, and it's starting to cost a lot of money to store that kind of data. So that's one of the big things I've seen. And the other thing is, as Johnson County grows, we're seeing more and more violent crime. We're becoming more of a big city instead of a suburbia when I first started work here in 1991. And so I think that's just part of the growth. We're starting to see some of our older neighborhoods that are a little bit more at risk. And so law enforcement is trying to dedicate resources to keeping those places safe for the people that live in those areas. And so those are probably the two biggest changes I've seen over the years.
Is there organized crime in Johnson County?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There.
Mafia?
I wouldn't go to the point of mafia, but when I talked about those fraud groups that roam around, there's some that live here in the metro. That's their whole job is to try to rip people off. Some of them roam across the country, but there's also organized groups that they dedicate 24/7 to ripping people off, and that's probably the biggest thing that we've seen. You know, the other thing is the uptick in what we call drug rips throughout the metropolitan area.
What's a drug rip?
Drug rip is basically, if you're my local drug dealer, I'm going to sign, instead of paying for my drugs, I'm going to rob you. And we've seen a lot of juvenile crime. The first of this year, we had four or five cases within a 60-day period where juveniles and young adults were doing this, and people were dying and being shot. And then that wasn't just in my jurisdiction, but across the metro. This is the biggest problem we have right now, is violence related to drugs. And you would think it would be opium or fentanyl and stuff like that. Most of the time, you know what it is? Marijuana or THC cartridges. You're killing people for those things. That's what we see across the metro.
Steve Howe, we've got to have you back. Promise you'll come back?
I will promise to come back. And can I give a quick shout out to happy birthday to my son Jacob on his 18th birthday.
Happy birthday.
Oh, hey. Somebody just got dad of the day.
Yeah, yep.
Hey, don't screw up in front of the U.S. Supreme Court next
week.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And if RBG falls asleep, I'll give you $1,000 if you go, wake up!
I'll pass. Thank
okay,
you.
Okay, all right, damn it.
Thank you for having me on.
$1,000 unmarked bills. You don't have to pay taxes. Steve Howe, the Johnson County DA. Festivus Friday is next. It is brought to you by Michelob Ultra. Get your grievances in early. We're going to free up the phone lines now at 576-7798. 576-7798.
Thanks for listening to the Dana and Parks podcast. Remember, you can catch us online anytime at KMBZ.com.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.